Elaine Pagel's Why Religion has become something of a phenomenon in spiritual circles, frequently cited by celebrities from Oprah Winfrey to Russell Brand as a transformative text that bridges intellectual rigor with raw emotional honesty. Unlike most academic works on religion, this memoir has crossed over into mainstream consciousness, appearing on bestseller lists for months after its publication, and sparking conversations about the role of spirituality in modern life. What makes this book particularly remarkable is how it defies categorization, part scholarly exploration of ancient texts, part devastating memoir of personal loss. It speaks to both the mind and heart in ways few religious texts manage to achieve. Growing up in Palo Alto's giant marshmallow of suburban comfort, young Elaine rebelled against her scientist father's atheism when she answered Billy Graham's altar call at 15. The evangelical experience opened vast spaces of imagination previously inaccessible in her emotionally repressed home. While her parents were horrified by her religious turn, this moment sparked a lifelong quest to understand why religion persists despite scientific advancement. Her childhood home concealed painful dynamics beneath its beige sofa normalcy. Her distinguished scientist father erupted in terrifying, unpredictable rages. Her mother offered little emotional comfort, responding to confidences with dismissive, "you shouldn't feel that way" rejections. Only her Dutch grandparents provided genuine warmth, her grandfather flipping pancakes over rafters and teaching her to care for animals, demonstrating the love absent at home. Long before finding Jesus, Elaine had discovered other worlds through books like The Wizard of Oz and Robin Hood, along with poetry, music, and dance. These offered glimpses of a spiritual dimension virtually non-existent in her upbringing. Her high school circle expanded to include artistic rebels like Paul, an intense 16-year-old who quit school to paint, introducing her to a world illuminated by creative energy. When Paul's father threatened to commit him to a mental hospital, Elaine joined a sociology course that placed students in Camarillo State Mental Hospital. There, she met patients like Maria, a suicidal 18-year-old Hispanic girl who'd gained weight to ward off sexual assaults, and 6-year-old Samantha, who clung to her for daily story time. This experience revealed how institutions often made people more helpless rather than helping them heal, challenging her understanding of normal versus crazy. After Paul's death in a car accident, Elaine found herself wrestling with profound questions about mortality. Though she'd abandoned Christianity, she remained fascinated by its persistence and power. Why hadn't religion died out as her scientifically minded father predicted? Who was Jesus really, and how did the story of a rural rabbi who was tortured and killed become a worldwide movement still spreading 2,000 years later? When she applied to Harvard's doctoral program in religion, Professor Krister Stendahl responded that while she was qualified, they couldn't admit a woman since women students always quit before completing the degree. They offered conditional admission for the following year. Her father warned that graduate school was crazy for a woman. She should become a secretary or elementary school teacher instead. Despite this discouragement, she stubbornly held to her plan, completing a master's in classics at Stanford while her grandparents offered unexpected blessing and financial support. At Harvard, Elaine felt out of place among mostly male students, many of them ministers supported by invisible wives working as secretaries and teachers. Despite feeling lucky to be admitted, she discovered hazards, particularly predatory professors. 4 weeks after arriving, a German divinity professor had her babysit his children, then trapped her overnight and attempted sexual assault. He later became her advisor and continued his predatory behavior. Years later, she learned other women had similar experiences with him, and therapists at Harvard Health Services privately called him Kuster the Molester. The academic environment was intellectually exhilarating but socially challenging. Her naive desire to find Christianity's essence was quickly dismantled by professors who revealed file cabinets of secret gospels she'd never heard of. Thomas, Philip, Mary Magdalene, discovered in 1945 and only recently available to scholars. For the first time, heretics could speak for themselves through their own texts, changing everything we knew about early Christianity. While visiting California to see her ill grandfather, Elaine reconnected with physicist Heinz Pagels, whom she'd first noticed years earlier at Stanford. Their intellectual connection blossomed into romance as they discussed their respective fields, his physics and her religious studies. When Harvard offered her a fellowship at Oxford, Heinz encouraged her to go rather than asking her to stay, saying, "Love doesn't tie people down." Despite her attempts to forget him, she couldn't. After Christmas with his family in Pennsylvania, he proposed, transforming Central Park's snowy landscape into the backdrop for their engagement. When Elaine told her advisor about their marriage plans, he exploded, claiming Harvard had wasted 4 years on her education, a stark contrast to how men's marriage announcements were received. The couple chose traditional Episcopal vows for their wedding, believing they transcended personal control, while celebrating afterward with friends at Rockefeller University. Their first summer together brought an uncanny experience. They were assigned the very apartment where her friend Paul had lived before his death. She sensed his presence by the window and internally welcomed him before the feeling departed. Heinz and Elaine shared fascination with consciousness. He wondered if physicists discovered particles or created mathematical constructs. Having once volunteered for an LSD experiment at Stanford, he encouraged her to try it. Her experience revealed everything alive as gloriously intertwined fire, resolving her horror about death into a vision of deeper unity. After completing her doctorate with distinction, Elaine began teaching at Barnard College while working to translate and publish the Nag Hammadi texts. When colleagues invited her to speak at a women's conference about early Christianity, she initially declined, believing they lacked information about women's roles. Then she realized the secret gospels contained abundant feminine imagery for God that her male colleagues had overlooked. In texts like the Secret Revelation of John, divine figures appeared as father, mother, and son. Other texts reimagined Eve not as Adam's tempter, but as his spiritual teacher. After 7 years of struggling with infertility and 3 years of intensive hormone treatments that took both a physical and emotional toll, Elaine and Heinz finally welcomed their son Mark on a crisp October morning in 1983. The day was particularly memorable as thousands of runners streamed through New York City's streets during the annual marathon, their determination mirroring the couple's long journey to parenthood. Initial euphoria turned to deep concern when doctors discovered a significant ventricular septal defect, a hole between the chambers of Mark's heart. While this condition would have been a death sentence just 5 years earlier, medical advances now offered hope through groundbreaking surgical techniques. After careful deliberation, the medical team advised waiting until Mark's first birthday when he would be stronger for the operation. As the surgery date loomed closer, Elaine experienced a profound spiritual vision that would stay with her forever. While praying in their darkened apartment one night, she sensed a menacing presence and, drawing on deep spiritual reserves she didn't know she possessed, forcefully invoked Jesus Christ's name 3 times until the threatening energy dissipated. This powerful moment gave her an unshakable conviction that Mark would survive the surgery. The operation itself was successful, though the aftermath proved emotionally devastating. Seeing their tiny son in intensive care, his small body virtually hidden beneath a web of IV lines, monitoring cables, and breathing tubes, tested their resilience. When Mark recognized Elaine's voice and lurched toward her, accidentally dislodging several needles, a nurse harshly reprimanded her. This incident triggered a crushing wave of maternal guilt that masked a deeper, more primal feeling of helplessness in protecting her child. During this challenging period, an unexpected blessing arrived in the form of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. The prestigious award provided 5 years of substantial financial support, timing that seemed almost divinely orchestrated. This grant gave Elaine the freedom to focus on Mark's recovery while maintaining her scholarly work without financial pressure. The family gradually established a new normal, aided significantly by Jean Da Silva, an experienced and compassionate nanny who became an essential part of their support system. Their tentative peace was brutally shattered during what should have been a routine cardiac catheterization. The procedure, typically completed within an hour, stretched into 9 excruciating hours of waiting, each passing minute amplifying their anxiety. When doctors finally emerged, their faces grave, they delivered devastating news. Despite the successful surgical repair, Mark had developed pulmonary hypertension, a rare and complex condition causing dangerous blood pressure elevation in the lungs. The prognosis was bleak. Doctors used the phrase invariably fatal and admitted there was neither treatment nor cure. When the medical team pressed for a lung biopsy to study the disease's progression, Elaine's maternal instincts and scholarly skepticism united in firm refusal. She saw the proposed biopsy for what it was, a traumatic procedure that would advance medical research but offer no benefit to Mark himself. They took Mark home and resumed a semblance of normal life. Mark returned to school, played with his friend Bram, invented elaborate games, began karate lessons, and became fascinated with He-Man cartoons. Standing on a redwood stump once, Mark struck a karate pose and declared, "I came here to fight." Understanding, Elaine felt that he was indeed fighting against death for the vivid flame of his young life. After a miscarriage, Hines and Elaine began adoption proceedings through the Gladney Center in Texas. When they received the call that a baby girl was available, they flew to Fort Worth, only to learn she was born 2 months prematurely and couldn't come home until her due date. Meanwhile, Mark dreamed they would leave them in the cemetery they passed daily, revealing his awareness of his vulnerability. When they finally brought their daughter home, the social worker asked what they'd name her, Sarah. Hines and Elaine looked at each other in amazement, remembering that over a year earlier, Mark had mysteriously told Elaine, "I'm the kin of dragons, and the queen of dragons is named Sarah." One evening in April, Mark clung to Elaine at bedtime and said, "I'll love you all my life and all my death." The next day, during a routine blood test at the hospital, Mark stiffened and his eyes rolled up. Despite physicians' efforts, Elaine sensed his life leaving his body. When she fell unconscious, she seemed to enter a brilliant green place with golden light. After reviving, Hines and Elaine spoke to Mark, feeling his presence near the ceiling. His heart briefly restarted, but soon stopped permanently. Though many couples separate after losing a child, Hines and Elaine drew closer, united in their grief. They felt devastated yet also relieved from years of tension. The sword hanging over their lives had fallen. 2 months after Mark died, friends invited them to a dinner dance. Though hesitant, they went, finding unexpected comfort as other dancers seemed to protectively surround them, like elephants nudging wounded members to the center of the herd. After Mark's death, they traveled to California, where Elaine created a ritual at places he had loved. Taking jewels from his favorite bead store, they left them at meaningful spots, the fallen log airplane, the treehouse, the creek, acknowledging their memories. In Colorado, they settled into a semblance of normalcy with 13-month-old Sarah, who was now walking and running. Elaine found solace in practices she'd learned from Cistercian monks at St. Benedict's Monastery near Aspen. Father Thomas Keating taught her meditation and contemplative prayer that helped calm emotional turbulence. Unlike others who offered awkward platitudes about faith sustaining her, the monks provided silent, unspoken support, never rushing to fill silences with empty comfort. Just as life seemed to be regaining some balance, tragedy struck again. In mid-July, Hines came home from a bike ride with bruised and bleeding knees from a fall on gravel, but insisted it was nothing important. That Friday, Elaine drove home grateful to have survived their previous ordeals, certain they'd always be together. The next morning, Hines left early to hike Pyramid Peak. When he didn't return by early afternoon, Elaine received a call that he had fallen. Hours passed with no news as she paced anxiously. Late in the afternoon, Seth arrived with police officers. They'd found Hines's body and taken it to the hospital. Returning home, Elaine focused on caring for Sarah, who wandered through the house troubled and crying, and baby David, who needed feeding and holding. Despite her shock, she arranged for friends to be with Hines's mother when she received the news. For days, she couldn't sleep, except in brief moments when she'd be with Heinz, alive and present, only to wake to the shattering reality. 3 days after Heinz's death, Elaine visited the Trappist monastery where Brother Theophan sat with her in silent prayer. In the monastery's silence, she felt her vigilance drain away. Internally, she cried out to Heinz, "So, how do you feel about this?" To her shock, she heard a voice saying, "This is fine with me. It's you I'm concerned about now." Angry, she responded, "Fine with you? You leave me here with two babies and it's fine with you?" She was completely surprised by this exchange that sounded like him but couldn't have come from her own thoughts. Her grief manifested as fierce anger that she initially resisted. Our culture works to shut down such feelings, as anthropologist Renato Rizzaldo noted in his essay on grief. He only understood the Ilongo tribe's headhunting practice after his own wife's accidental death unleashed in him powerful, visceral, emotional states and rage beyond endurance. His experience helped Elaine acknowledge her own anger. Without close friends, survival seemed impossible. Heinz had kept her balanced as a parent and person. Driving mountain roads alone, she'd catch herself speeding dangerously, not wanting death, but desperate to stop the pain. Yet suicide wasn't an option. Heinz would have stood on the side of life for their children. During sleepless nights, Gerard Manley Hopkins' words echoed, "No, I'll not. Carry in comfort, despair, not feed on thee. Can something, hope, wish day come, not choose not to be." Rereading biblical stories, Elaine discovered a stark contrast between cultural attitudes toward anger. While the Ilongot people of the Philippines celebrate anger as a natural and cleansing force, Western culture, heavily influenced by biblical tradition, often treats it as something shameful to be suppressed. Genesis explicitly shows God warning Cain to master his rage before it masters him, while throughout the Old Testament, righteous anger is consistently portrayed as God's exclusive domain. These ancient storytellers made a crucial narrative choice. Rather than risk blaming God for catastrophe, they created Satan as a malevolent trickster figure who tempts and leads people toward destruction. This literary device provided communities with someone to blame when grief and rage threatened to overwhelm their faith. During those dark days after losing both her child and husband, Elaine found herself drawn to Job's story with a new, painful intimacy. The crushing weight of her losses led her to question everything. Surely, she thought, only a fundamentally failed mother and wife would suffer such devastating blows. Was this divine punishment for some transgression she couldn't even identify? The biblical narrative structure systematically redirects grief away from anger and toward guilt, a pattern she recognized as the harsh notes of self-blame threatened to drown out her legitimate anger at fate's cruelty. When she re-examined Job's story more closely, it split open like a blood-red pomegranate, revealing layers of meaning she'd never before noticed. What we commonly call the Book of Job actually weaves together two distinctly different literary traditions. The outer frame presents a folktale of a man maintaining unwavering faith despite losing everything, while the poetic core reveals a far more complex character who boldly curses the day of his birth and demands God appear in court to justify his suffering. In the months following Heinz's death, Elaine's nights were haunted by dreams of him, each morning bringing the fresh shock of remembering his absence. On the first anniversary of his death, seeking peace, she drove to a monastery for meditation. Instead of finding the consolation she sought, she was seized by a visceral vision of his fall from Pyramid Peak. But this time, unlike her previous fragmentary flashbacks, the vision continued in brutal detail to his body shattering against the rocks, blood flowing freely. Later, her grief counselor explained this as a necessary, if traumatic, part of processing sudden loss. When someone dies in an accident and survivors cannot view the body, their psyche often needs to fully visualize the death to begin accepting its reality. This brutal imagination serves as a bridge between denial and acceptance. While researching her book, The Origin of Satan, Elaine explored how people had spun this figure out of their own conflict and pain. Her research unexpectedly revealed the origins of Christian anti-Judaism as early gospel writers shifted blame for Jesus' crucifixion from Romans to Jews to protect themselves. This defensive storytelling had horrific consequences through centuries of persecution. In the Nag Hammadi texts, Elaine found alternative visions that powerfully nurtured hope. The poem Thunder, Complete Mind echoes how people have heard thunder as a divine voice, but instead of Zeus or Israel's god, it personifies thunder as a feminine power speaking in paradox. Her voice declares divine presence shines everywhere, in palaces and garbage dumps, embracing all we are. I am the first and the last, the one who is honored and scorned, the whore and the holy one. I am she who exists in all fear and strength in trembling. I am the one who has been hated everywhere and who has been loved everywhere. Other texts speak powerfully of spiritual awakening. The revelation of Zostrianos tells of a young man planning suicide who walks into the desert to deliver myself to the wild animals for a violent death. A luminous presence challenges him. Zostrianos, have you gone mad? And he enters a cloud of light that rescues him from despair. Finding courage, he declares, I knew that the power in me was greater than the darkness because it contained the whole light. Unlike the Book of Revelation's apocalyptic visions that have fueled wars for centuries, the Nag Hammadi revelations speak of spiritual breakthrough. The secret revelation of John describes how the grieving disciple encountered Jesus appearing as light, declaring, I am the Father, I am the Mother, and I am the Son. This revelation offered consolation through a divine presence envisioned as the original Trinity, Heavenly Father, Son, and Holy Spirit as Mother. The Gospel of Truth from Nag Hammadi opens with the profound declaration, the true gospel is joy, and unfolds into an intricate, poetic myth about the pre-creation cosmos. Unlike the straightforward narrative of Christ's crucifixion found in canonical texts, this gospel presents an elaborate cosmic irama. It describes spiritual beings who, having become separated from their divine source, experience profound existential anguish until the Father, in an act of compassionate intervention, sends Jesus as the hidden mystery to guide these lost souls back to their celestial home. This alternative gospel radically reinterprets the symbolism of the cross, transforming it from an instrument of brutal torture into a new tree of knowledge, a symbol of enlightenment rather than punishment. The text suggests that human suffering isn't divine retribution, but rather serves as a universal connector, binding humanity both to each other and to the divine. This interpretation markedly differs from traditional doctrine by rejecting the notion of God as a severe judge demanding Jesus' sacrificial death, instead painting a portrait of a loving Father who sends Jesus on a mission of recovery and reconciliation. The perspective aligns with William James's influential definition of religion as an individual's total reaction upon life. James observed how different temperaments naturally gravitate toward different forms of spiritual expression, a notion explicitly supported by the Nag Hammadi texts. The Gospel of Philip, in particular, offers a sophisticated understanding of spiritual diversity, comparing different approaches to spiritual nourishment, suggesting that just as bodies need different types of food, souls require different forms of spiritual sustenance. Through her personal journey of devastating loss combined with rigorous scholarly investigation, Elaine Pagels discovered that religious narratives transcend mere intellectual constructs. They function as powerful solutions of the imagination that actively shape reality and human experience. Her work emphasizes that what truly matters isn't the rigid structure of religious institutions, but rather the dynamic engagement with imagination, whether through dreams, artistic expression, poetry, or music, as our spiritual needs evolve throughout life's journey. The text suggests that transformative experiences, often emerging from our deepest suffering, serve as gateways to previously unknown dimensions of existence. These painful passages can lead to profound personal evolution, fostering new relationships with ourselves and others that might otherwise remain undiscovered. The wisdom contained in these ancient texts suggests that mystery itself holds transformative power. Rather than providing simple answers, they invite ongoing exploration and personal interpretation, acknowledging that spiritual truth often reveals itself gradually through life's experiences rather than through dogmatic proclamation.